Hello and welcome to Don't Miss a Beat, presented by HCP Live Cardiology. Don't Miss a Beat is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Muthu Vadaganathan, and my co-host, Dr. Stephen Green, providing regular news roundup, latest evidence, and clinical trial insights across cardiovascular, renal, and metabolic diseases. The audio versions of Don't Miss a Beat are available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on hcplive.com.
Welcome back to this episode of Don't Miss a Beat, hosted by hcplive.com and featured on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. This series is co-hosted by my dear friend, Dr. Stephen Green. And here today, we are live from Prague at the ESC Heart Failure Meeting, and we'll be having a spotlight on heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. In 2023, at this ESC-HFA meeting, HFpEF has really taken center stage in multiple late-breaking clinical trial sessions in which new data are being presented to round out our understanding on foundational medical therapies and their intersection at various phenotypes of heart failure. And so we thought it would be timely to revisit the clinical approaches to HFpEF today. And specifically, the ACC, the American College of Cardiology, recently released an expert consensus decision pathway. And this was perhaps one of the first of its kind focused around the topic of HFpEF and the clinical approach to a patient with suspected or definitive HFpEF. And we thought that it would be a great opportunity to unpack some of the synthesized information in this document. But before we dive in, Steve, I wanted to get your take. You know, we've seen a number of these expert consensus decision pathways from the US. We've seen a number of consensus statements from the European Society of Cardiology and other leading cardiovascular entities. What do you see as the role of these consensus documents, especially when we consider them adjacent to perhaps more established guidelines?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Muthu. You know, from my perspective, and I'll say I'm a big fan of a lot of these expert consensus documents. I think they're so incredibly useful. I think, you know, in broad strokes, the guidelines as really the what one should do, and really then these expert consensus documents as the how someone should do it. I think that in general, the expert consensus documents, of course, are congruent typically with the guidelines to a very high degree, but they kind of give things down in a more digestible, more algorithmic, formulaic approach that I think really hits home for the person, you know, seeing these patients every day. And I think this HFpEF document is really no exception. You know, true to form, lots of great algorithms, figures, graphs that really dictate how one might think about heart failure with preserved ejection from a practical approach. And then the other comment I'll just say is that who would have thought we would have an expert consensus on HFpEF management, you know, even, you know, 5 or so years ago, when we're so used to, you know, in all these various papers and publications, just thinking, oh, it's limited to management of comorbidities, limited to, you know, maintain optivolemia with diuretics. But now, as you're saying, you know, we're seeing here in Prague, it really is center stage for the heart failure community. And there really is a lot to know and really a lot of information to digest for taking care of these patients.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in parallel with guidelines, expert consensus decision pathways, regulatory bodies have been quite active in really taking in and approving therapies for this entity. We now have a third therapy to join sacubitril valsartan, empagliflozin, and then now dapagliflozin to be approved really across the ejection fraction spectrum in chronic heart failure. And so now it's really left to clinicians shared decision-making with patients to best understand how to integrate these therapies in practice. So let's dive into some of the details here. And I think that guidance document or the expert consensus decision pathway is broken up into different sections, but really a bulk of it is a conversation around diagnosing HFpEF, which is perhaps one of the major reasons why this entity has been so difficult to understand, study, and treat in clinical practice. So how do you view some of the kind of core takeaways from the expert consensus decision pathway in terms of diagnosis?
Yeah, so I think it's great. They did a great job, I think, really, in kind of making this very digestible, as I had said before. You know, they talk about different definitions of heart failure with really a center focus on the universal definition of heart failure. But instead of just, you know, regurgitating what that definition is, again, the key things to understand that they highlight, you know, natriuretic peptides, obesity, you know, that interaction, which is also a bigger potential thing to consider in our diagnosing of HFpEF. But then very practically, they took a step back and thinking about what about the patient with dyspnea and or edema? You know, that, again, we see this all the time, but it's not necessarily always HFpEF, or at least garden variety HFpEF. And again, true to form, they have these great algorithms that really kind of take one through. You have a patient with something on exam. How do you actually work through to think about extracardiac or cardiac, you know, manifestations of this that may or may not be related to HFpEF? And then we'll think about mimickers, which might be things like amyloidosis or other things that have a very treatment-specific approach to therapy. And then you finally start getting about some of the scores and risk scores for really confirming a diagnosis of HFpEF. And then you actually have that diagnosis of HFpEF. So I think, you know, again, starting with things like universal definition, but kind of melding that with very algorithmic approaches to these signs and symptoms that we commonly see was really, you know, a thing that I think will be highly utilized by folks. What are your thoughts, Mutu?
No, I couldn't agree more. I think that that approach to the, you know, either a fairly undifferentiated patient with dyspnea or edema, I think was a wonderful starting place, because that's often where we initially meet the patient, whether in primary care or cardiovascular care. Upfront differentiating a litany of really non-cardiovascular reasons, and then honing in on the diagnosis of heart failure. I think the final elements of that pathway that they outline include when to assess for heart failure mimics. And I struggle with this in clinical practice because we, of course, have a number of tools available to us to understand some of the specific mimickers that may otherwise masquerade as a garden variety HFpEF syndrome. And I think that they have outlined key clinical clues that might hone us in to a specific diagnosis that we should pursue in practice. So instead of a one-size-fits-all, really undertake a broad evaluated framework to these clinical clues to guide the next kind of the next steps. That includes evaluation of cardiac amyloidosis, for instance, with LV wall thickness, perhaps some musculoskeletal issues or neuropathy, specific diagnostic schema for instance, evaluation of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, especially in the absence in an individual in absence of hypertension, perhaps cardiac sarcoidosis with extracardiac manifestations of the disease or advanced heart block at a young age, and perhaps also less common mimickers as well. And so I think that was a particular area I really enjoyed looking at and reviewing, because often we are compelled to undertake a kind of shotgun approach in terms of diagnostic evaluation and assessing all individuals with, for instance, advanced cardiac imaging options. And this is a more practical approach, I think, that can be applied.
I think that's a great example of how that's different than what a guideline document might get into, right? You know, talking about things like sarcoidosis and, you know, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy diagnosis. And again, the differential diagnosis. I think just one key point here is an example to highlight differences between guidelines and the very practical application of these expert consensus documents.
Perfect. Steve, I wanted to ask you, you know, in cardiology, we love risk scores, and in this case, diagnostic scores. And so talk to me about the two major HFpEF algorithms or scores that are out there and how this document kind of framed those scores in that clinical approach to diagnosis of an undifferentiated patient with dyspnea or edema.
Yeah, no, and it was great to have these two scores really get a lot of attention here, because I think, you know, sometimes in clinical practice, we forget that there are these really, validated scores that can be helpful for diagnosing HFpEF. And they're on either side of the Atlantic here, from the Mayo Clinic and our good friend, Dr. Reddy and Dr. Borlaug up there. They have the H2FpEF score, which is really, it's six variables, and they're all very clinically easy to derive. They're very in routine clinical practice. It's very user friendly. Starts with, you know, BMI greater than 30, two or more antihypertensives, atrial fibrillation, pulmonary artery systolic pressure greater than 35, age greater than 60, or filling pressures as defined by E over E prime ratio greater than 9 on echo. So these parameters here are something that, you know, most centers, and just by looking in clinical documentation, we can get these parameters, and a score greater than 6 on their algorithm gives pretty good confidence that we're dealing with a HFpEF diagnosis. Then on the other side of the Atlantic, we have the HFA-PEF score, which is also very well validated. I will say, in the guideline, expert consensus document actually went so far as to say it is more involved than the H2F-PEF score, and perhaps not as user-friendly. So we won't potentially get into specifics right now into it, but again, you have two scores at our disposal that are both scientifically very well validated, with maybe a slight edge in user-friendliness to the H2F-PEF.
Perfect. And I fully agree. A couple of the nuances that I thought were of particular interest is the H2PEF score doesn't actually include natriuretic peptides. And so natriuretic peptides are really used adjacent to the score. And so that may even provide complementary information. The European algorithm, one of the core features is emphasizing in this stepwise approach the need for even provocative testing or exercise testing in certain cases. And I think this document took a little bit of a step away from that, mainly because of access to CPETs in most clinical centers in the US and worldwide may be limited. And so this is meant to be a more perhaps generalizable approach in this expert consensus decision pathway. But that said, I think we've all been faced, especially with patients with these clinical symptoms of dyspnea and edema, who have perhaps a cardiovascular substrate, but have strong non-cardiovascular comorbidities that may still be driving those symptoms. And so disentangling that in clinical practice often is fairly challenging. The other notion that I thought was quite helpful was actual specific patient cases that they offered with deferring H2PEF scores, but with the exact otherwise same presentation. And the notable pearl there was that in a patient presenting with a clinical syndrome of HFpEF, but with a low H2PEF score, that might be considered a zebra or may flag you to actually pursue some of the other cardiovascular mimickers or perhaps even non-cardiovascular comorbidities that may be driving the dyspnea. So the example that they offered was a person with carpal tunnel syndrome who was relatively lean, who didn't have the classic comorbidity set of HFpEF and had a low H2PEF score. That patient should be evaluated perhaps for cardiac amyloidosis with pyrophosphate testing, as well as consideration of light chain disease. So I think that these were all wonderful kind of components in the diagnosis. Let's turn to treatment. The treatment phase of HFpEF, again, has been surprising to us that we are already at a expert consensus decision around the treatment and management of HFpEF. But talk to me about what these authors put forth as what we should be doing in clinical practice in a routine patient with, let's say, garden variety HFpEF.
Yeah, so I think, Mutu, no surprises here. You know, SGLT2 inhibitors really at the top of the algorithm, you know, really recommended for all patients with HFpEF that have no absolute contraindications. So it was great to see. The other thing with their algorithm that they show, which is also the noticing the color coding of it. You know, in a lot of ways, the algorithms and the expert consensus documents, they try to have the color scheme usually concordant with what the guidelines use. You know, class ones are greens, two A's are yellows, and then two B's are generally orange. Well, here for SGLT2 inhibitor, it was something I've never seen before. It was yellow, but with a green outline. So the yellow would reflect that maybe the 2A recommendation that we just had in the 2022 ACC-AHA guidelines. But the green, if you read the legend, this was saying that, well, now there's the DELIVER trial, which you obviously know very well. They are the authors of the expert consensus document. And I think you and I would think that the next iteration of the guidelines likely would have a class one recommendation for SGLT2 inhibitors in HFpEF, or at least across the full spectrum of ejection fraction and heart failure. But I'll pause there, Mutu, and get your take on the SGLT2 inhibitor guidance and the expert consensus.
No, I agree. I think we all fully anticipate in the very near future that guidelines will be upgraded. I thought that it was forward-looking that they placed this as foundational. And then with consideration or strong consideration in this case of additional therapies in the symptomatic patient with HFpEF. So what I found actually most striking was not the SGLT2 inhibitor recommendation, which I anticipated, but was the recommendations for the other therapies, the MRA and ARNI and ARB, which was considerably perhaps broader than what we would have what we see in the current guideline sets. And I think that they importantly distinguish between men and women here, and that they noted that because women may benefit to many of these therapies to a higher ejection fraction, in fact, all women with a clinical syndrome of HFpEF should be treated with an SGLT2 inhibitor, MRA, and ARNI if they can afford and tolerate those three therapies. Whereas in men, they noted that men tend to benefit to at least a lesser ejection fraction. So an EF of 55 to 60% or below, those individuals should be considered for an MRA and ARNI. So just curious, kind of what is your take on that? These types of sex-specific guidance hasn't really entered into clinical practice guidelines, but should it? And how do you approach it in your own patients?
Yeah, no, it's I started with SGLT2 inhibitors because that's the no surprises there, not controversial at all. I was surprised that the guideline, the document here was very bold in having, you know, sex-specific treatment differences very explicitly stated. On one hand, we do have a lot of secondary analyses and subgroup analyses from the clinical trials that do suggest that women tend to benefit from things like ARNI in MRA at higher ejection fractions. But it's always hard, you know, where do you draw the line with, you know, secondary analysis and subgroup analysis and then, you know, meeting the bar to get into professional society documents. But I think the case is certainly supported by the totality of the data. You know, you see all these analyses with the spline curves, for example, and you show that the hazard ratios for whether spironolactone and HFpEF groups or sacubitril valsartan, it does seem to stay below that line of unity for hazard ratios and rate ratios, higher, longer for women than it does for men. And so my own clinical practice, I'll be honest, you know, for patients that have very high ejection fractions, you know, greater than or 60%, and maybe they have something that maybe gives me cause with maybe they may or may not be likely to tolerate sacubitril valsartan or spironolactone, I do oftentimes think of sex as a tiebreaker on whether it's, you know, worth the benefits outweigh the risks for trying that therapy in someone with a very high ejection fraction. So I think, again, in line with this document being sort of a practical clinical approach here, I think it is something worth considering. I think the community should be aware that there are data out there that do suggest differences by sex with treatment response.
Perfect. And I, you know, the other aspect that I think in this treatment section was around de-implementation. They did discuss some of the perhaps less evidence-based strategies or non-evidence-based strategies that are commonly used in a HFpEF patient, including beta blockers without another evidence-based indication, such as recent myocardial infarction, atrial fibrillation, perhaps in select cases, hypertension. And in those cases, I think that withdrawal or weaning of the beta blocker might be beneficial. Similarly, nitrates are often used in this population, again, with questionable clinical use, perhaps even some signals towards harm. Furthermore, in many of our patients, we see potassium supplementation in which could also be potentially spared with use of MRAs or other therapies. And so I think that the document was quite helpful with a number of pearls embedded in not only the figures that were quite helpful, but also in the text. I want to move to the question around referral. You know, we, at least in the United States, it is, you know, just speaking in broad terms, we have about 2 to 3 million people living with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. We have about, give or take, about 24,000 cardiologists who are practicing and licensed. And we have about 1,000 to 1,500 board certified advanced heart failure transplant cardiologists. And so, especially in certain regions of the US, specific states, even specific rural areas, we just can't, based on that workforce, refer all our patients with heart failure preserved ejection fraction to a heart failure specialist, much less a cardiologist. And so does the document actually take us through how we can approach this? Who do we select to say this person might need additional support with under cardiovascular care or heart failure care?
Yeah, it's a great great point, Muthu. And this document does give us nice algorithms for referring to, from either it's primary care to general cardiology or general cardiology to advanced heart failure. But your points are very well taken, how, you know, there is this potential supply-demand mismatch between, you know, what might be needed and maybe suggested by a document like this versus what is actually available today. But needless to say, I do think these algorithms, mnemonics in this case, are, you know, very well taken. It kind of builds off the I need help mnemonic. They got a lot of publicity with a prior expert consensus document, that one for referring or thinking about advanced HFrEF. But in this document, you know, we have the mnemonic check in. This is for referring to from primary care to a cardiovascular specialist. And this includes things like cardiorenal syndrome or, different need for diuretic agents that might be beyond what a primary care doctor might be comfortable with. So there's a mnemonic there called check in. And then that other escalation in potential referral is from general cardiology to heart failure specialist. And here we have the mnemonic inhale, which includes things like frequent hospitalizations, low blood pressure. But I think to get back to your point that you really opened up this segment with is, you know, the supply demand mismatch that you're hinting at. You know, one thing that we, you know, as an advanced heart failure trained cardiologist, you know, one thing that I'm seeing in my field of advanced cardiology, advanced heart failure, is this issue with us not being able to fill fellowship spots nationally when you look at various programs and whatnot. And this is actually such a concern that the Heart Failure Society of America actually recently organized a task force to say, hey, what gives? How are we going to drive more enthusiasm and interest in our trainees to actually pursue an advanced heart failure specialty? And I think when you think about HFpEF, you know, advanced heart failure training currently is primarily focused heavy on transplants and LVAD therapy, things that aren't really relevant in the vast majority of circumstances, the HFpEF, much more HFrEF focused. But here now we have an expert consensus document actually trying to normalize the idea of having a HFpEF patient seen by an advanced heart failure specialist I think it just puts more onus on us as a heart failure community to really, we need more clinicians. We need people that are trained in advanced heart failure. And I hope, you know, those things like the HFSA task force can really generate enthusiasm, as well as us trying to shift our training a little bit from being just VAD and transplant centered to really acknowledging, you know, the treatment of patients with just chronic heart failure in general. But what do you think, Mutu?
No, I agree, Steve. I think you positioned that so nicely in terms of not only do we need to build greater capacity for broader expertise of general cardiologists and advanced heart failure doctors, but in addition, we need to empower primary care doctors and other clinicians in the management of HFpEF. And this is a growing syndrome in the U.S. and worldwide. And so more care and more thoughtful care is going to be of paramount importance. And we didn't have time in this short session to discuss many of the other aspects of this document, including in-depth look at comorbidity management, multidisciplinary care, and of course, non-pharmacological therapies. But there's no question that HFpEF will continue to be of substantial interest to the cardiovascular community and the medical community at large in the coming years. Even at this HFA Congress, we see new data being presented, for instance, from each of the therapeutic classes being discussed. We have new secondary analyses from the SGLT2 inhibitor trials. We have a third HFpEF clinical trial evaluating ARNI, sacubitril valsartan. That is the Paraglide trial evaluating ARNI in the context of worsening heart failure, which will join Paragon and Parallax. And of note, Parallax, which was a trial that wasn't a clinical endpoint trial, evaluated NT-proBNP and functional status, will soon report on clinical events as well. And so we will see a whole new set of data related to how these therapies affect higher ejection fractions. Furthermore, we'll see the baseline data from the Fine Arts Heart Failure Trial. This is the largest trial of an MRA in HFpEF. Evaluating now a non-steroidal MRA called finerenone. So much, much more to learn. And I would be remiss to not mention that there are a number of novel therapeutic strategies beyond these foundational heart failure, traditional or conventional heart failure therapies being now tested in HFpEF. So look out for this exciting space because it continues to evolve at a really very rapid pace. So Steve, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Oh, very well said, Mutu. And again, it's great seeing you, and the PROG meeting is fantastic. Yes, I can't say it better, Mutu. I mean, again, as I said earlier in the segment today, who would have thought years ago that we would have an expert decision management pathway for managing patients with HFpEF? And I think now with SGLT2 inhibitors and the emerging data for the other therapies and guideline recommendations, really, we now have opportunity cost for not getting patients on the best appropriate therapy. And hopefully documents like the expert consensus pathway will improve physician comfort, whether you're a primary care doctor, general cardiologist, or an advanced heart failure specialist, that the field has moved beyond just management of comorbidities and use of diuretics. We now have therapies proven to improve patient outcomes, make patients feel better. And it's up to us as a community to build that capacity to take care of this growing population. So with that, I want to thank our audience for listening in to this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. You can find this episode and others on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or hcpcardiology.com. We'll see you next time, and thanks for joining.